This is the beginning of class 11.
Sanshi Bhagi Shushin Hesop Shang Vira Vinshi Nyende Kempati Sangye Shindu Mithe Uwagi Jogu
last course, because these are, you know, somebody asks you what's pramana, and what do you say? not perception. You can have a perception that's wrong. You should say valid perception. Of course, all you know now is correct perception. When you get to Madhyamika Prasambhika, it's more valid perception. Is there a difference between correct and valid? You think more. But correct just means almost all the perceptions you ever have in your life are tema, okay? And basically, tema is useful for only saying the right thing. You know, you shouldn't say anything unless you have a tema about it. That would be refreshing if everyone in the world... I know I don't do it, and I meet people who do have that quality, and I admire them. So I think it's a very good quality to develop. You know, only talk about what you have tema. And if you don't have a tema about it, you say, I think. I think Franklin said, Benjamin Franklin said, in his younger days, he used to be very opinionated, and later, when he got older, he decided he would attach, I think, to everything, and it saved him a lot of grief. He said. So think, just imagine how many cases there are where you, it's pretty sure that you know, but you don't really know, and then you have to be careful. So that's tema. Tema is where you actually know the thing. You've actually seen it or perceived it, and logically is okay, but it has to be airtight, which is difficult.
You could say, I believe certain things to be the case, right? Based on what I understand so far.
Yeah, that's fine.
Michael, isn't that also like sort of a matter of just being truthful all the time as well? Right?
That's what tema means. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to get. Okay. What is the Buddhist definition of existence? We'll go around. What's the definition of
That which is perceived
by a tamma. Okay, anything which is perceived by a tamma. See, I know it exists because I saw it, or I thought about it with a tamma. Everything else you don't know if it exists. You don't know if a Buddha exists, really, unless you have a real good tamma right now. You don't know if Buddha exists. You don't know if Bodhisattva exists. Really. Theory, they can, and maybe if you studied a long time, you could argue for it. A lot of difficulty. Okay. Helen McHale. What did the Buddha say himself? What did the Buddha himself say is the purpose of Buddhist monks? Do you remember?
Something to the alphabet. And at the end of that, there's this big ashy pit.
Should not what? Only he or
should not judge another.
Can judge another person. Okay. Only a Buddha, not a Nandava Mayimba. Kasaki Tsusomi Chatanya Mandrasari. Unless you are me or only he or
should not judge another.
Can judge another person. Okay. Only a Buddha, not a Nandava Mayimba. Kasaki Tsusomi Chatanya Mandrasari. Unless you are me or a person like me, meaning, you know, you can read the other person's mind. A normal person shouldn't judge another person because you will fall. You will fail. And after the break, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that. That's the first thing that we learn in logic in the monastery. At age 15, normally, they teach you that line. They never even know where it comes from. They have no idea what scripture it comes from. They just memorize it. That's an excellent question. I'm glad somebody finally asked. No, logic is the deductive process by which you achieve a tema, by which you could judge another person.
But you can only judge another person if they're Buddha or they have a tema or not.
Only a Buddha can have a tema or not.
But you can only judge another person if they're Buddha or they have a tema or not.
Only a Buddha can have a tema or not. Maybe.
Only Buddhists have a
tema. You can read a person's mind before that.
They're saying a regular person can deduce it.
Well, let's say that it looks to you that somebody might do an extraordinary thing for a special reason. And you always have to keep it in the back of your mind that this person might be doing this for a special reason. You know, or something like that. You know, something that looks strange to you. Or, what I'm saying is... That's understanding logic, because logic is knowing that you don't know unless it's logical, unless there's three parts of the proof. You know, he is a bad person because I saw him do that. Right? What are the three parts of the proof? To the proof, he did that. True. If he did that, he's a bad person. True. You know, but did he do that for that reason or something? You see, you have to have logic. You have to now analyze the three parts to the idea. We didn't get into logic. It's a whole nother. You're going to study it someday. I was afraid too many people would drop out.
So were you just saying, I just saw somebody do something where I saw is normally done by bad people.
Yeah.
That person could be a bad person.
That's all right.
But not necessarily.
Fine. But I don't know for sure.
I don't know
for sure. And I don't know what his motivation was.
In any event.
Maybe he's going in there to save somebody from hell. You know, I don't know. It could be a bodhisattva. You know, I don't know.
In any event, what I saw was done by bad people, usually.
Normally.
Doesn't mean this person.
Right.
Hey, Michael, why would a bodhisattva or Buddha choose something that is destructive, meaning like killing someone, hurting someone, instead of using some kinder ways, because kinder things perpetuate kinder things.
Normally, they would. They say that about the subject of violence, even as protection, they say, pretend the person is your own mother, pretend she went out of her mind temporarily, pretend she picked up a knife and went at you. You know, you wouldn't try to kill her or break her legs, or you know, you would try to disarm her or hug her or stop her somehow. You would think of any other way than to hurt her.
And I saw a bug with the Buddha killing that guy in the ship. Why didn't they tie him up? Why did he have to kill him? He could have tied him up and he could not kill anybody.
It was trained in such a way that he had to make the choice at the moment. And that he saw with every kind of semen that it was the only way to stop him at that moment. You know, somebody said it to the Dalai Lama in L.A. He said, if you're standing next to the guy and he has his button, the button on the atomic bomb, he's going to lay it off. Do you kill him? And the Dalai Lama said, well, I'll let you know when the time comes. If it ever happens to you. Something like that. Okay.
Is that word fail or fall?
Mm-hmm.
Is the word fail or
fall?
Fall.
F-A-L-L. Yeah. And it's meant in a literal sense. You go down to hell. And you'll see why. I'm going to tell you a little story.
I still don't understand the direct connection between logic and how using logic or not using logic will cause you to fall.
What it means is don't believe assumptions. We have studied it. Each assumptions or presumptions or estimations or approximations are not semi.
So is he saying...
He's just saying, if you don't have a semi, don't judge other people.
Don't use logic to judge other people.
No, you can. If it's an airtight logic. This is a bad person because I can read his mind.
So the inference here is... So the inference here is if you have accurate logic, it's okay to judge them.
Oh, yeah. That's what Robin Landau... If you have a tema... But do you ever have a tema? That's the point. Unless you're like a Buddha. Unless you're Buddha in mind. And that has implications at the very highest teachings of Buddhism. And to follow that code would be very good from now, because there's no reason not to. It's logical to do that now.
So are you saying then, if you could have airtight logic, you should follow it to judge people, but we can't have airtight logic, so we should never judge people?
Normally it's very hard. Normally, unless you're like...
You could judge people. That's also
it doesn't mean follow them if they're evil. It doesn't mean don't resist them if they're evil. You're required to resist evil. But just realize that you don't know. You know, you're just resisting it on the best of your knowledge. But you must resist. And as you get better, and if you follow your vows more carefully, you must resist. Okay. Hikari, two levels of tema.
Oh dear.
Oh dear, that's not one of the... What are two kinds of tema? What are two ways to perceive them?
Oh.
Easy, you don't need
to. With your eye?
No.
Or... Well, when you see, when you...
One is obvious, like the wall.
Yeah.
That's what? That's direct. What's the other way?
Indirect.
Yeah, indirect meaning...
By logical deduction.
Number two is totally good, valid, cool. You know, use it. You need it. What's that? So number one, direct perceptions, how many kinds are there?
Three.
Well, you can say your eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and then your thoughts, your direct thoughts.
Okay,
those are all direct perceptions. When they're correct, they're direct temas. Right? Now, what if you use deduction? That's only mental. You can't use deduction with your eyes and your ears and your nose. Okay? Your eyes,
logic,
ears, and your nose
right?
can never be indirect. They can never be deduction. Yeah, logic. And you use logic constantly. Every moment of the day, you're using logic. You're not aware of it, or you don't think of it as logic, but all day long, you're making decisions based on logical processes. Even when you speak, you're using grammar is based on logic. Okay. What two levels of reality to those two are they useful?
The obvious.
Yeah, evident reality.
And then hidden reality.
Hidden. Hidden or deeply hidden goes into the second category. Okay. So obvious reality is like these colors or this feel on your arm or smell of my dog or something like that. That's evident, too evident. And then hidden things, okay, are like real subtle impermanence, emptiness, the workings of karma. Those are hidden. Even what's behind my table here is hidden for you right now. What's inside my table here is hidden for you. You don't know what's here. You can't see it and you can't deduce it perfectly. You don't know what I got under here. So for that, for you now, that's hidden. Alright, yeah.
So we use the workings of karma as an example of object and a deeply.
We're including hidden and deeply hidden together as something that has to be perceived as what?
Indirect.
Logical. That's the whole point of this class, actually. Spiritual things you can't establish with your direct senses. I mean, the real important spiritual principles you must establish with logic. You must think it over carefully and then come to a point where you understand, oh yeah, there must be a past life. There must be a future life.
Well, what about, like, for example, when you believe that good things will bring you good things and you adopt that kind of
depends on if
thought.
It's done by belief or by logic. I think at the end of the karma class, especially in the last two classes, you'll receive an explanation of karma, how it's stored in your mind. That's very acceptable. At least it was very exciting to me. And I think then it will become a deduction for you that you should act good, because you understand the process by which seeds are stored in your mind every moment of your day, and that they must come out later. So when you get that explanation, I think you'll be following karma out of deduction. But right now, it's just out of that you're attracted to Buddhism, you studied it in your past life, and you feel that it's good or right, you know, but you don't really have any proof. And that's a dangerous situation to be in. Someone could talk you out of it.
Yeah, but what happens if you adopt that kind of thing and you notice that it really is true? If you do good, you know.
If it's based on your experience, I don't think they say that establishing karma with your personal experience in this life is very difficult, because you can have really sweet disasters happening from your old karma. So it doesn't look, you know what I mean? You can be good for years and then have cancer, and you know, people give up Buddhism because they think not true, and that doesn't prove anything. You know, you see what I mean?
Mm.
Or you can be evil your whole life and still get rich, and you see that. Well, you see what appears to be that.
Am I getting my glasses mixed up, or is the deeply hidden objects can't even be produced by, deduced? They have to be taken on faith?
Actually, they're a kind of. Taking on faith is a kind of deduction. That's a subcategory of deduction.
Right. Can we make that distinction in the class?
Okay, it's a subcategory of deduction. So it's all right. Okay? All right. This basic. Give the text of Master Dignaga's opening statement.
Can I read it?
Can I read it?
Okay, thanks. I bow down to the one who turned correct, who helps all beings, the teacher, the one who went to bliss, and our protector.
Yeah, okay. It's not just, if you read that in the opening of some book from Wisdom or Snow Lion, you just skip it. Sounds pretty boring. All those Tibetan books start with that kind of thing. Now you know each word is a code word. You know, hopefully one day you'd be able to explain it to somebody. The whole process by which you become a Buddha is revealed in those words, right? Very important. So you really should know it. If somebody says, what do you study? You say, I study Pramana. Well, do you know anything by Dignaga? Well, I know these two lines, you know, and that's enough. That's the most famous thing he ever said. So if that's the only thing you know about Dignaga, that's a great one to know. All the paths of Buddhahood is revealed in those lines if you know how to read them.
If we were to recite these out of order, these things, it would be incorrect, wouldn't it?
We studied that in the seventh class, I think.
Yeah.
There is an order to it, and there's a reverse order to it. There's two ways it goes. And it's not obvious in the words. It's not evident in the words, as we struggled with. Okay. All right. Philwell, you were here for this one. Give the definition of balance. By the way, it's not anyone's fault that I mean, I don't make fun of anybody for not coming to all these classes. I won't kick out anybody who, if you attended a reasonable number of classes and you passed the final, you passed. Just this time. Next time we'll go back to normal because I'm not working for this. Okay? And I can't go to India for any reason. Definition of balance.
Fresh and unmistaken perception.
Yeah, very simple. Fresh, unmistaken perception. Yeah.
Are you using valid perception as different than prominent here?
No, it's prominent. Yeah. I vacillate between correct perception and valid perception. I think correct perception gives a correct perception to a normal person more quickly. It's actually valid perception, but we didn't go into that distinction in this class, and we will in another class, when we get to Prasangika. All right. Actually, it should be valid, but I don't want to get into it. Vilma. Describe the term, what does it mean to say temekibu, person of valid perception? Basically, what's the basic meaning of that? Yeah, and
he has valid perceptions.
Yeah. And then the other thing you should add is that he cannot lie. He's incapable of lying. He only has valid perceptions, and he only speaks about what he really knows about. And that's a Buddha. It's sometimes used for other kinds of great, you know, spiritual masters theoretically, any Buddhist philosopher should only speak about what he knows, what he has a tema about. It doesn't have to be a direct tema, but he should have some kind of tema about the subject that he's talking about, or he shouldn't talk about it. Or he shouldn't say, I know. Amy. You did really good in this course. You're one of the best people in this particular course. She must have been a logician. Anyway, I'll see if I can give you a question that you get wrong. What are the three main methods for a normal person to determine the Buddha is totally correct about the deep teachings that he gave? Three methods to see that the Buddha is correct about the Buddha. We had another question that was similar later. What was that? Doesn't contradict
reality.
What you know to be true directly.
Your direct perception.
Your direct perception. Okay. If the Buddha comes up and says this wall is red, then you say no, it's not true. I know I can see it's not.
Unless I become colorblind.
And I'm not crazy. Yeah, number two.
No, it's not inconsistent.
Yeah, internally contradicting. That's number three, actually. And number two is what? Number one was doesn't contradict.
Isn't number three,
contradict.
If it shocks you...
No, that's a different set of three.
Sorry.
Two sets of three. The other one's coming.
I don't know.
Easy. Sorry. You said direct perception.
It's not
much.
No, it's direct and indirect.
Good, yeah, that's
and
all.
Then it's not
doesn't offend your... Doesn't contradict what you know to be true directly. Doesn't contradict what you know to be true indirectly or by your own logic. You know, if I say I have an elephant back here, I have a real life-size elephant behind here. You know, that contradicts or offends your deductive logic. Because if there were an elephant here, it should not fit in this little box. So it's not true. You can't confirm what I said. And then the third one is, and that's probably most important, should be internally consistent. What he said at one point doesn't contradict what he said next. And there's supposed to be this point, and you will appreciate it someday, where every single statement in Buddhist scripture is consistent, totally consistent, with every other statement in Buddhist literature. And you'll reach a point someday where you really appreciate that. Right now, I'm sure there's some nagging ones that you think are contradictions, and that's okay. I mean, it proves you're thinking about it. But I think as your study gets deeper, you will come to a point where you're comfortable with every single statement in Buddhist scripture. Okay. Robin, three ground rules for interpreting the Buddha. Like, how do we know when the Buddha is speaking figuratively and not literally?
Well, if what he says appears to
contradict what was said, that's one of the tests. It offends your knowledge, what you know to be true. That's actually number two.
And the first one is by discerning the intention behind.
Yeah, I mean, what was he really trying to say when he said "sutso mala tomanisu so"? When he said form is emptiness, if color is emptiness, and emptiness is color. What did he really mean? Oh, color has emptiness, and emptiness is the quality of color. He didn't mean that color is emptiness. If color were emptiness, you and I would be Aryas, you know, right now. So you can see it directly. So that's, yeah, there must be something, you must be trying to say something. What was his true intention? That's the first one. Number two is, it offends you what you know. And number three was?
To say it, but I don't
think
the
first number one is, what was he really trying to say? And then number three is, why did he choose to do it this way? And normally it's for shock value. You know, he overstates something, he exaggerates something. He says, kill your father and kill your mother. You'll never forget that. If I said, you know, well, please try to have renunciation, you'll forget that by the time you take your break. If I say, kill your father and kill your mother, you'll always remember that I said that. Hopefully you remember that it means renunciation. It doesn't mean to kill your father's mother. But there's a reason, you know, when the audience is going to sleep, you exaggerate. You say something, you know, outrageous just to get people to pay attention and to remember what you said. Those are reasons why he might say that. He said all of the schools, the three and a half schools that are not the highest Madhyamika school are all figurative. You know, there are major points in them which are not true. There are many points which are true and which are shared by the highest Madhyamika school. But all their other ideas about emptiness are wrong. And he said them for a reason. In that case, it was that people couldn't handle the higher explanation. He spoke it on a level that people could handle. That's another common reason for him to use figurative descriptions, because people just weren't ready to hear the higher ones. They would freak out, and I've seen it. I've seen people have that here.
Is there a connection between this idea and the breakdown between the interpretive?
That's exactly that. That comes from that. The reason I brought it up in this class, because you'll have a whole course devoted to that subject, which was one of Tsongkhapa's favorite subjects. He wrote the definitive word for it. The reason I brought it up in this class is because we had just said that he never contradicts himself. And I knew people would say, well, it sounds like this contradicts that. So then I thought I'd better teach you the ground rules for when he wants to say that. And that's why I stuck it in here. It's not part of Dharmakirti's arguments.
But how do you know that, in other words, he's covering all the grounds. This way you cannot say he was contradicting himself. No, if he says something and contradicts it because he was trying to say something else. But if he says something like this, it's because he means that. So no matter what he says, he's always trying, you know,
he's
you're always
covered, right?
Yeah, he's always covered. How do you know that, you know, it's not a game, that it's not, you know.
I think you study them deeply, and then you appreciate the need for them and how they can help people at different levels. You'll get to where there might come a day when you're at work and somebody asks you a question about Buddhism, and it dawns on you that if you tell them the correct answer, it'll never help them. So you decorated it a little, you know, you changed it a little bit, and then you just became a figurative speaker of Buddhism. You know, there was a compelling need. If you had told him the truth, he would have said, "Well, this is crazy. Buddhism is silly." You know.
So couldn't the middle schools or lower schools say, oh, he only taught the higher school because
do.
Of people for that
oh,
mentality?
They do, yeah. Sure they do.
So.
That's all. But you study the higher school and then you can corroborate it yourself. Mm-hmm. You can come to a realization that it's correct by studying it carefully. That's the whole purpose to have classes. you know, is that you could actually establish emptiness intellectually, and then you can go and meditate and just see it. You know, so that's the whole purpose to have a class. If the subject is taught correctly, and if the speaker of the subject is correct, then you should be able to just come to a class and learn it and go home and know it. And that's the idea of a class. You know. Okay. What does a person have to know in order to be all-knowing? A mission, according to Buddhism. What you should take up and what you should give up.
Okay.
The things that you should take up and the things that you should give up. And the Four Noble Truths break down quite nicely between the two. How do they break down?
Suffering
is a cause of suffering, what you should give up. Yeah. And the cessation of suffering is a path, the cessation of what you should take up. Yeah. Okay. So what he's saying is, Dharmakirti has that beautiful verse. He says, it's not enough to create some big special ship that goes down to the bottom of the ocean and takes pictures of all the little creatures there, and that makes you omniscient, or you get a telescope and you see all the stars out there and you name them all and you know where they're going to be going and who's going to hit who in 30 years. You know, that's not omniscient. That doesn't qualify. It's to know what is suffering and to know how to get out of suffering, you know, perfectly. This is something useful. This is something meaningful. You know, if you've got to give me an omniscient person, give me this kind of omniscient person. I don't care about a person who's seen every physical object there is. That doesn't for me make him omniscient. That doesn't help anybody.
That would also be a subset of the other.
Actually, it would be. Actually, it would be. But it sounded good.
But okay. should give up suffering, yeah. You said?
If you break out things that you should take up and things that you should... What John is saying is, of course, the Buddha would know all those things, by the way. I mean, if you want to know all the bacteria at the bottom of the ocean, he could tell you. But he wouldn't tell you that way. No, he would start telling you why they're going to die in 30 seconds and why you might be born as them. And, you know, he would frame it that way. Two of the Four Noble Truths are to be abandoned, are to be given up. That's suffering and its cause. Meaning suffering and bad thoughts.
Right.
And then two of them are to be taken up, which is the path and the cessation. The ending, permanent ending of all your bad thoughts.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Damgarni, what evidence do we have that the Buddha is unerring? I changed the homework question slightly. The quiz question said, you know, how do we know? Why is the Buddha unerring or something like that? And I think I prefer to frame it this way. What evidence does a normal person have that the Buddha might be unerring?
Because of the perfect description that Buddha gives in the first Aryan truth of suffering.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can't confirm that all your suffering comes from your bad thoughts right away. You can't confirm that. You can't confirm the subtle workings of karma. You cannot confirm that there is a cessation, that there is nirvana. You can't confirm that acting a certain way morally and with meditation and with wisdom that you might be able to reach that state. That takes time to confirm all those things. But you can absolutely quickly confirm that the Buddha, of all the beings who have ever lived on this planet, gave an excellent description of suffering. And a very subtle description, you know, all three kinds of suffering. Suffering of suffering, you know, obvious suffering, which all religious teachers have basically addressed. Suffering of change, which many religious teachers have addressed. You know, that anything good turns sour. And then the suffering of, the pervasive suffering, the suffering that just by being alive, you suffer. And you must suffer. He stated that very clearly, and he explained why. And that's just that description of suffering, especially the third one, is quite attractive, I think, to any thinking person. Any person who's been alive for a while has to notice these things. Excuse me? It is actually sometimes described as the fact of your aging. the fact that the five parts to you, your five keys, are inherently bound to collapse and deteriorate. And that's basically chamati cheki tunya. That's the pervasive suffering. That's the meaning of the pervasive suffering.
It doesn't apply to people, it applies to non-material.
Yeah. But no, not really. Not a thing, except if insofar as they're related to you. No. Okay, back to Laura. I think. Oh, wait. We got mission guiding. And we got Ariel. Way nice thing. Hey. Oh, I'm going to do the next one. The next one I messed up when I explained it to you. I gave two different explanations. What's the difference between normal compassion, great compassion, and holy great compassion? Correcting the homework was very much a suffering for me. I realized I didn't explain it very well. And I gave two different schools' viewpoints, which were totally different. There's actually three mixed up there. So I reread it and I restudied it. And I remember debating it, but I don't remember what it did. So this is the answer I want on the quiz. This is the official line, okay? Normal compassion, regular old compassion, means wishing that people close to you, your friends and relatives, should not suffer. Wanting to see your friends and relatives get out of suffering. People that you like. Great compassion, mahakaruna, ningje chembo. That is the desire that all beings. I've stopped. Wait. That comes in two flavors, okay? And you'll have to write two different flavors, okay? There's two different kinds of great compassion. The kind which is had also by Hinayana practitioners, okay? That's the first kind. It's called Chandugi Ninja. Chandugi means wishes that all beings could be free of suffering. That's the first kind of great compassion. It wishes that all beings could be free of suffering, and Hinayana practitioners can have it. And now another subcategory of great compassion is it's called the great compassion which wishes to protect those beings yourself. Like taking responsibility to actually go and save those beings from that suffering. That's called kyobdu. And that's had only by Mahayana track people. Technically, they're not even bodhisattvas yet because it's equivalent to Patsamnamda, step number 6 in the 7th step for you people who are in that other form. It's just before you achieve bodhicitta. You get the real wish to take on that personal responsibility to do it yourself. Even if no one helps you, even if people obstruct you, even if people don't care what you do, even if people talk bad about what you do, even though there are other Buddhists and Bodhisattvas around to do it, you say, it's my job to do it and I'm going to do it. That's the last step just before you achieve bodhicitta, actually.
This may be a fine point, but you know, so this is a motivation. You have this motivation. You get this motivation. I personally am going to free everyone from suffering. But let's say you never act on it. What does that mean?
That's the distinction between domsem and chosem. We have two kinds of bodhicitta.
Like sugar cane.
They're both real bodhicitta, but one is swearing to do it, and the other is actually going out and doing it. There is that distinction.
Inspiring
and engaging.
Engaging, yeah, I like that. Okay.
Wouldn't aspiring be the same as the Hinayana?
No. Because it already assumes the other
moment.
Oh, holy great compassion, okay, which is called Tukje Chembo in Tibetan instead of Ningje Chembo. They use the honorific word for mind instead of the normal word for mind, heart. So it means great honorific heart rather than great heart. Tukje Chembo, or holy great compassion, is distinguished from regular old great compassion by what? What do you think?
foiled you.
Yeah, only Buddhists have it because only Buddhists have the ability to do what the last one we talked about wanted, which was what?
Help everyone. Yeah.
Help wanted to be the one to save them. So only the Buddha has the ability to save them.
So what do you define that?
You're saying they actually do
it? It's the kind
it?
Of great compassion only possessed by a Buddha, i.e. only by a person who has, actually has the ability to save people. So that's the key thing in holy great compassion. The being who has it in his mind stream also has the ability to actually save people. And only a Buddha has that.
So it seems like we have a gap here. The previous one, the second of the two great compassion, led us up to, but not including becoming a bodhisattva, right?
Well, they describe it as being Mahayana. It's technically the step just before bodhisattva, but it would include people with bodhisattva who are not Buddhists. Yeah.
Where
are
bodhisattvas in
this? Obviously in number two of the great compassion. They want to be the one to save people. But technically speaking, you could have the wish to save people and not quite yet have reached bodhicitta. Technically speaking, there are such people. Don't worry about it.
Can we say that there are people?
It's a Mahayana Buddhist.
Can we say that there are those other than Buddhas who have holy great compassion?
Right. Yeah, you
can
say that.
Because you could say
those other than Buddhas who are Mahayana. There's only Mahayana people.
The second kind of great compassion. I'm talking about the third one.
Because they do have the ability to actually carry it out.
But they both have, great compassion, holy great compassion, those have it in their minds.
Yeah, sure. Buddhas have both. And bodhisattvas have both kinds of great compassion, obviously. They want to see people get out of suffering, and they also want to be the one to get them out.
So the great compassion is only the wish. There is no engagement there.
You could have the engagement, but you don't have to have the engagement.
But you don't have the ability to suffer.
You're engaging, but you don't have the perfect ability. Let's say that.
You're trying, but you're messing up occasionally.
Well, there's a big debate about it. I mean, some people say you aren't no good to anybody. There's arguments like that in Buddhist scripture. That until you can read a person's psyche, you know, his spiritual psyche, perfectly, you don't really know what to do to help them. There's a big argument like that. Yeah.
So I guess then, finally, the holy great compassion, which is only had by a Buddha, I mean, a Buddha would also be acting that out all the time as well, right? I mean, you can't...
By his nature.
You can't be a Buddha and sit passively with this ability.
There's a famous verse by Tsongkhapa. It says... I can't remember. We recited every Sunday. Anyway, which means, which means, you, O Buddha, you know, you don't have two mental functions you're incapable of. Not knowing the trouble we're in, and not caring about it. And the reason I haven't been able to make contact with you yet directly is my own bad deeds. There's a line like that in Tsongkhapa's description of the Buddha. Which means, he's always aware of your situation. He's always waiting around, he or she. He's always, you know, right around you, waiting to help you, but you keep messing up and creating this karma that prevents them from helping you.
While at the same time doing that for many, many, many other things.
There's debates about that in the Abhidharma. That's a whole subject. Okay, next. Basically, on any millions of planets, one Buddha can act. Yeah. And does act. All right. Cold?
It is cold.
Too cold. Okay. I'll put it on a low setting. Okay.
Yeah.
Ariel, you there? Okay. Three reasons why the Charvakas believe that the mind dies and the body dies.
Mind is
the
part of the nature of the body.
Right.
The mind is the same quality of the body. Right.
And then the mind is the result of the body.
Oh, the mind is the result.
And they should be in this order, okay? The order is the mind is a quality of the body.
The nature.
A quality of the body. And then secondly, the mind is a part of the nature of the body.
It's different.
And we're going to talk about the difference between them. And then thirdly, the mind is a result of the body. I think this is the order. Fresh in my mind. Okay, and I'll explain the difference, okay? And I'll do it this way, which is nice, I think. Don't forget the examples for the three. The mind being the quality of the body was, the example was one. Not for quality, it was different. Yeah, like the ability to intoxicate and alcohol. What do you call it? Like the intoxicability.
Potential.
The potential to intoxicate in alcohol. And alcohol itself, the ability to make you drunk is a quality of alcohol. It's like an innate, essential quality of alcohol. It has it. If it doesn't, it's not really qualified as alcohol. Okay, it has the ability to make you drunk. That's a quality. Okay. The second example was part of the nature, and the example was a drawing on a wall. Okay. Drawing on a wall.
Design on a wall.
A design on a wall is part of the nature of the wall. And I have to study it more. I did not study it perfectly. The Tibetan words there are not different. Rangshin and Chinyi or something like that, they're not different words. But I take it to be a dependence relationship. The way that a painting depends on the wall. Okay, the way that a drawing depends on the moment. Okay, then it's on. And I'll explain why. And then thirdly, the mind is a result of the body, and that's like what?
Lamp.
Yeah, the light, and then the lamp that it comes from. I mean, you can't see it, but when you turn the light on, it takes a few, you know, milliseconds for the light to get from the lamp to your eye. You have to assume that. You can't see it, right? So the light is really the result of the light, a lamp. By the time the light reaches your eye, that moment of the lamp is already passed. Right? And that's the nature of cause and effect. Now, I ask you, and I'll start with Amy, since you're looking up. You gotta look down all the time. This is good. Which of those three do we believe as Westerners? I mean, which one were you brought up to believe?
All three.
What's that?
All three.
I think all three, but how so? Like, discuss maybe.
Well, the result.
How do you think mind?
If you get hit, if your brain is damaged, you die. Well,
yeah, I would say.
Severe enough.
I would say that. If you ask most Americans, we had a Friday night class, and we had Friday night classes. People who just wander in, they don't know any Buddhism, and you say, "Where did the mind come from?" And they said, "Well, you know, your cells." Your mommy and your daddy stuck us together, and then enough cells split, and then until there's a nerve, until there's a line of nerve cells, and then an impulse passes down that line of nerve cells, and that's your first thought. And that's, I think, what most of us grew, you know, that's what we were grown up with. That's what they told us as we grew up, you know. They told us that's how it works, you know, that's how mind starts. So in that case, mind is what? It's a result of the body. I mean, the body gets pretty well developed and then mind can come. That's what a lot of Westerners, that's pretty much what I was told when I was a kid.
And the body can get undeveloped and mind will stop.
Apparently. Okay. By the way, no proof, absolutely no proof of that. Right?
No, I'm saying you asked for the way Westerners think.
Yeah, yeah. And then what about the nature one?
What one?
Or let's say the dependence one, like the painting on the wall. By the way, dependence is always simultaneous. This is supporting the other at the same moment. They both exist at the same moment. The body is holding up the mind. And when the body collapses, the mind poops out. That's pretty much what our vision of death is, I think. Mm. I think our belief shifts over to painting on the wall when it gets to death. Because we believe that the mind is resting on the body or on the brain cells or whatever. And when the brain cells, are pulled out like the tablecloth, then the thing falls down, And that would be number two. And number one, I think, describes what we believe about life and living cells, living tissue. We believe that life is an innate quality of living cells. We believe that once there's a cell, a living tissue there, then those cells have life, and that's the quality of those cells. That's the very nature of the cell. Cell has life. It's a cell of life. And I think that would cover the alcohol and the, that seems to be a very quality of a living cell is life.
Isn't
life
that the definition of the senses? Haven't we defined that as sentient?
Yeah.
So we defined in both.
It's a long story. But what I'm trying to say is that as I think about it, and it's not obviously not in Dharmakirti, is that we believe all three really. We believe everything except the right one. Which is what, by the way? What's the relationship between body and mind?
The mind
animates
the body.
The mind caused the body. The mind caused and supports the body. The body and the mind continue and are caused by the mind. Your past karma. Okay. We had that in the last few classes. Right? Dharmakirti is like pulling a complete... He says not only is it not those three ways that you describe, Chavaka, the truth happens to be the opposite. The reason you have a body right now, and the reason you didn't die yet, and the reason your mind is still flowing on, is because of former instances of mind.
You didn't talk about if the mind would be the brain. I don't think I remember what you're talking about.
That's if you believe the mind is the brain, you believe one of those two Chavaka arguments. Neither is the mind, the brain is supporting the mind.
In terms of proving that that's not it.
Difficult. But the main key we'll get to. That's a question. In fact, the next question. Explain the meaning of material cause. Your name is you.
it's the stuff that turns into the result. And the example is the acorn tree and the oak tree.
Yeah.
It's the prime cause as opposed to the secondary factors.
Yeah, so material means this. I hate to keep using the word stuff, and obviously you can't use the word stuff in your scholarly publications. They have it to be the nicest description of what happened. It's the stuff that turns into your mind. And I leave you, if all you remember from this whole class is that according to Dharmakirti and according to all Buddhists, you cannot make a mind from a rock. Impossible. Different stuff. Cannot happen. Never will, never did.
Why don't you just say germane?
I don't know what germane means. People have told me times in the war. No, germane means relevant, right?
I think you really want to get back to what it really means, originally means.
Okay, yeah.
It's better than
the
coffee.
It's the mature
mind
of next course. Yeah. That's great. I love that. Shouldn't the Chavaka come to say, Dharmakirti, come on, don't be a fool. You've been arguing that it has to be the same stuff, and now you're saying that mental stuff causes physical stuff, Well, you're making the same argument we did.
So how
we have to talk about it. When we talk about the mind-only stuff, basically, it's not creating physical stuff. In the highest levels of Buddhist philosophy, it's a perception creating a perception of physical stuff. Right? It's a perception. Mm-hmm. Previous perception creating perception of physical matter. not physical matter.
Where is the physical matter?
You are your perception of yourself. Your body is your perception of your body. That's Dharmakirti's only way out.
But what about on a relative level? The body is this, just this
God. It doesn't, and on that level, the Nyerlenki view of the body is the element. Chemical.
Your
body can't be chemical. Yearling view of the body is the element. According to Dhammakirti too. He only said what? Your mind was a special, unique basis. Okay. If you read your notes, if you read the readings, he says basis. He's very careful to use a different word. He says unique basis. Because they've been arguing that the body is a unique basis for the mind. The body has an intimate relationship with the mind, such that the mind comes from it. And they're more stressing what goes on during life, but you know, not where it came from so much, but what keeps it going. All right. Helen, why can't the cause of your mind at birth be living physical matter?
Because the cause for your mind can't be living physical matter, because if all five senses or the sense powers were needed, then that what would happen if there was lack of one and not? Would it resemble one, not the other?
Yeah, I lost a few students on this question from the other class. It's a difficult question. You must split the answer. Okay? You must split the answer. Kedup Jay splits the answer. Dhammakirti splits the answer. Okay? Why doesn't your flesh, why doesn't your living tissue of your body cause your mind? Why is that not the case, that the living tissue in your body causes your mind? And the first thing you have to understand is that all the living tissue in your body has to fit into one of those five sense powers. You don't think of it that way, but think about it for a minute. And there's no part of the living tissue of your body which is not either your visual organ, or your tactile organ, or your taste organ, or your hearing organ, or your smelling organ. All the living tissue of your body has one of those functions.
Well, your liver is your blood purifier.
But when you cut the liver out, it is hurting very much. It's that stuff. I mean, it covers. That's, you have to imagine yourself as these patches of tactile, of these patches of sensitive cells. That's what you are. That's what your living tissue is. Okay? There's an argument in Buddhist scripture, therefore, what about the ends of your fingernails and the ends of your hair, not the roots. When you pull out your hair, the roots hurt. And they decide that it's not part of the living tissue of your body. But when you get down to the quick of your nails, it is. Yes, ma'am. She's going to tell me about some...
Why these are presented as separate logical arguments. They're not.
Which two?
Given.
These several ways.
Yeah, give us a second.
We're on number.
By the way, the arguments, if you want a quick answer, because then we really should go on. They do overlap. They're not meant to be.
The real argument is that it's not the same stuff.
That's the main argument.
This is a different example of that. Yeah. So why are we wasting? Do you know what I'm saying?
Because it's another. That argument covers everything. All of those arguments are sub-arguments of the big argument, which is that's different stuff. That's
because
true.
By definition,
but this is just making it more interesting.
Material cause.
True.
The
true.
Whole thing is...
True. It's a moot point.
Yeah.
Anyway, remember where that reasoning came. It was by a reasoning by what? Kedup Jay's reasoning is what? Elimination. He has to cover all possibilities. He has to go down the tree of possibilities until there's only one way left to go. So don't forget why it's coming that way. Okay, so why can it be? You have to break the question into two. The answer is two. the first part of the answer is, if it were all five senses, if it took all five senses for mind to occur, if the mind was a result of all five senses collected together, then anyone who lost one of those senses would lose their mind, I mean, would not have a mind. Which is not the case.
Is that the case where if you lose one sense, you lose 20% of your mind, theoretically?
Yeah.
Okay,
and then, on the other hand, if any one of the sense powers, and let's take the most powerful one, let's take the main one, your visual sense power, your eye sense power, if it alone could create mind, then mind should have some kind of similarity to that sense power, and the mind itself should be able to see with the same vividness that the eye faculty does, and it can.
You mean to imagine as...
Yeah, I mean, when you imagined that Buddha, you know, you look at that Sangha, and when you closed your eyes and imagined it, it should be every detail and every color, everything as vivid as when you're staring at it with your eyeballs, and that's not the case.
Not the case right now, but it can be developed. No?
Probably eventually. Yeah. It be
well, I mean, isn't that what all our practices are?
When a Buddha can do it.
You just jumped from the moment of birth to mind here. We're talking about two different things.
This is an argument for, you could say mind at birth, same thing.
Mind at birth, okay.
The question says mind at birth.
Okay.
So if it's just as vivid, does a Buddha even have such a distinction as looking at something and seeing it?
That's a very nice question. And the actual fact is that his senses are indistinguishable from his mind sense. In other words, with his little finger, the Buddha sees the universe. That's something inconceivable.
But I mean, if your mind is capable of such things, why would you need sense power?
Probably don't need it. Okay. The Buddha isn't actually... Well, I'm going to continue. That's 8th chapter of Abhisamayokara. We'll do it someday. We got to go quick. Why can't the cause of the mind at birth be outside physical matter? I'm going to answer, okay? You split the question again. And use the same reasoning, okay? If it took all four elements together, in other words, if every kind of chemical had to be there, then any time one of the chemicals was missing, then the mind shouldn't occur. And then on the other hand, if any one of those chemicals could create the mind, then the mind should have some similarity to that chemical. It should stink if it was sulfur. You know, it should taste irony if it was iron.
Isn't it true that if you had no water or no earth, you wouldn't have a body?
Yeah, he's talking in a substantial amount. I agree. According to Buddhist theory, all atoms have to have all.
Do you want to read that? I don't know.
Right. Oh, okay. I don't understand.
Remember, he's talking to non-Buddhists. It's hard. It means basically this. Basically, it's very interesting. If all those chemicals together are what creates mind, then to put it in normal English, you should be able to put those chemicals in a teaspoon, and a mind should occur, and those chemicals should disappear as a result. That's the meaning of a near-linky view. And and the opposite is so ridiculous that Buddhists have trouble thinking of it. To believe anything else is hard for a Buddhist. You know, he doesn't understand why people... You know, I mean, a person who is a good Buddhist scholar, I mean, why would you ever think that you could put certain chemicals together in a spoon and then something totally foreign as mind, could come out? And then those elements go away, you know, the chemicals go away. So, well, who would ever think that up? You know, why would anybody think that? And then, if you say, well, you don't have to have all those chemicals, you know, any one of those chemicals. Then he'd say, well, every time those chemicals go, who would ever think that up? Why would anybody think that? And then, if you say, well, you don't have to have all those chemicals, you know, any one of those chemicals. Then he'd say, well, every time those chemicals got together by accident, you know, some truck comes along and falls over on the New Jersey Turnpike and all those chemicals mixed together, and all these mines should pop off. And that was a big truck, you know, tractor trailer. And then you say, well, it only takes, what do you think, it only takes one of the chemicals, you know, is acid enough, you know, and then does the body somehow resemble acid? I mean, the mind. It's not.
And so why does material cause have to have built into it that it disappears?
It's the nature of all causes, actually. All causes disappear as the result comes out. When the result comes out, the cause must be thereby destroyed. That's just something you didn't think about. Even the soil around the tree, the part of the soil which nourished the tree has disappeared by the time the tree is here. This is why soil gets lousy in India after you plant corn in the same field for 30 years. This is happening to the soil.
Yeah.
It's
good, like, I asked about the
It's a long, long story. There's the Abhidharma Kosha, the second chapter. We will study it here. Many causes. Kinds of causes and the types of factors.
We're talking about other than material causes, it seems to me. Aren't we really talking about something else when we talk about
he's talking the main cause. Stuff that turned into mind. Okay, I shouldn't tell you.
They said something about projecting.
That comes much later. And that's when the Buddhists are giving their own idea. That has to do with the desire that triggers the karma.
Much right, proof number two.
Different thing. Yeah, it involved with that proof. But we were way back on proof number two or something like that. We're talking about outside physical matter.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead. I thought you were
You are too far ahead. All right. This is an easy question. If cause of mind is mind, if the stuff that turns into mind happens to be mind, why does it have to be your mind and not someone else's mind? And Dharmakirti says, well, then, you know, children of piano geniuses would be able to play piano perfectly from the first moment. And, you know, that's so simple that a lot of people objected to it on their homework. And don't take it as silly. It's true. But maybe it takes some time to cook it. It should be similar.
What was the question again? If mind was...
If you get down this Kedrup J's chart of elimination until finally you figure out that the most convenient thing to believe is that mind created mind, mind flipped over into mind, a mind of some moment before turned into your mind at your first moment of your life.
Right. Then
if you reach that point, then just to nail things down, he says, well, would it be your mind or someone else's mind? You know, could your mommy and daddy's mind flop over into your mind at the first moment of your life? And some Westerners believe that. That's part of our belief system.
But if you put it that way, wouldn't the mind that was the cause disappear when it flopped over?
It did. You died.
So she mean, wouldn't your parents drop dead?
You don't die when you give birth to a child.
The mind of the moment of giving birth is gone by the time that the child is born. We're talking moments by moments.
Isn't the tukkha the tukkha? I mean, in a sense, you're saying that this is true for the tukkha, whereas it isn't true. I mean, if the mind... You're saying that one's mind causes one... flops over.
Turns into.
And
I'm talking about a very specific mind. The first moment of your consciousness in this life. What was behind that black door the moment before? If we can establish 1 millisecond prior to that point of mind, our problems are over. What happened the millisecond before that? You know, what turned into that mind? Ask yourself. That's the whole point of this class. I mean, go home and worry about it, you know. First moment of consciousness in your mommy's womb. Very first instant of your mind. What came the instant before?
Are you saying the same thing?
Yeah. It's called nalakshchula. Definition of a direct cause. That thing which nalakshchula means like flipping a pancake on.
So why is this karma?
The flow of karma. We'll talk about it. Next class. This class does flow into the next class, and that's why. That question is why. That's why we're doing karma. That's a great question. That's the next natural thing you should be thinking about. If the last moment stops and then the present moment starts, how come there's any continuity?
Could you say, with, as far as the parent's mind flopping over to the child's mind, could you use something similar to the acorn in the tree where the mature mind of the parents has something like a seed which then comes to fruition as it grows in the child? And just like a tree gives a seed to the ground, the parent's mind gives a seed of itself to the infant which grows.
The Dharmacharya's argument is that you don't get, Jesus said the same thing, you don't get lemon trees from apple seed. Impossible.
Yeah, so the parent's mind going to the baby's mind.
There's this wonderful correlation between, this expectation that you can have. Think about how chaotic it would be if you had to go to the grain store and buy seeds and not know what was going to come out of them. I mean, that would be, Dharmacharya says, according to you guys, this is the way life would be. You say something totally dissimilar can give a result. You say that the body can produce a mind. Or you say that a parent's mind can produce a child's mind. You're postulating a thing. You therefore believe that results can come from things which don't resemble them. So, boy, you better not plant those corn seeds. You never know what you might get. You might get watermelons popping out. You could get horses jumping out.
If you're saying the child's mind...
You get your genes of your parents.
Of a similar kind.
No, I'm saying...
That thing has to have come before.
Well, a cause by definition is something that comes before.
Yes, but you Westerners are talking about something... Oh, no, there are kinds of causes that don't come before called an abhidhamma.
Well, then
you've got to
think of a different word than cause. Because in English, by definition, cause comes before.
Yeah, it's difficult.
What kind of things do you have before?
They postulate two. Mind and mental function. Symbiotic cause. One thing is helping one thing and the other thing is helping the other thing at the same time.
That's simultaneous.
Yes, it is. And the other
thing. It's not a causal relationship.
Well, if you took it away, the one would go away, and that's cause. Okay. The higher schools don't accept that. Okay.
So it has to come from something similar and it has
something
to come.
Previous. And not
from the body.
Not from
the body alone.
He didn't say that, but he just, that's the underlying principle. That's the main idea. It had to come before. It had to come before the first moment of the instant of consciousness in your mommy's tummy. Something came before. And that something had to be similar. Ergo, you have a past life. You have many future lives. You better be good. It's a long trip. Might as well clean it up now. All right. Explain why the mind of a normal person at the moment of death crosses into another state of mind at the same time. What makes it cross over?
Desire.
Desire. Okay. That's the argument. That's all he says. Because it has desire.
Because it has desire is the reason why?
It took us 2 hours to explain what that means. And you people who did not come to these classes. You know the key. By the way, the key is beautiful. The key is not just plain old desire. It has to be mixed up with grasping the self existence. And that's a long story. We studied the three types of desire that can trigger your karma. We studied the two types of karma that get triggered. We studied how it shows in your life. We studied how to stop it, which is of paramount interest for all of us. Alright, number 20. three parts of Master Dharmacharya's main proof of future life. Leave. That's actually the same as the last part. It's just a statement.
Oh. Consider the mind of a normal person at the moment of death.
Right.
It will cross the line into a future mind because it possesses desire.
That's all. That's his proof. That's his main proof of existence. Okay, almost finished. Then we're going to take a short break and come back, and I'll tell you 5 minutes. Promise. Promise you'll be out by 9 if you come back. Alright. Name and describe the three types of the eighth link in the chain of dependence from the wheel of life. This is it. What? The eighth link. Link number eight in that wheel of life. The guy, what was it? The monkey grabbing his
feet. Yeah.
No,
nine.
The guy feeding out.
Which is what we're all waiting to
that's
do on
the next. Come on, okay.
We can go through it. Miss Vilma.
What was the question again?
What are the three kinds? That eighth link is called craving. What are the three kinds of craving?
Desire craving, fear craving, and craving for existence. And the first one is desiring only not to lose attractive things, wanting to lose unattractive things, and desiring for the persistence of the self, fear of that moment of the self.
Yeah. By the way, he uses the word there I was struggling to translate today, dopa. Dopa means an unreasonable fear, an unfounded fear, a false fear. And I was trying to convey that in English for that translation. It doesn't mean the fear that you are finishing. It means the false fear that you are finishing. You see what I mean? There's a word, dopa in Tibetan means like paranoia, or dopa is what you do at your office when you think people are talking about you, and that's dopa. Dopa is why you don't want to step under a ladder. You know, superstition. It's all tied up to a stupid fear. Unfounded fear. You're not going
to think. But then you would be clinging to existence in that sense then. If it was an unfounded fear, then you shouldn't be afraid because you're going to go on.
Yeah, you see, the dopa means He grasps to existence, meaning his five parts to himself, because he thinks he's going to stop. The think, you know, in English, thinks means, but he's not really, we know, right? But, you know, that's why people scream when the airplane starts to go down. People, we all do, we all will, you know, you think you're going to end.
Isn't some of that well-founded fear of 99 out of 100 people are going directly to hell?
We will get into it. But what did we say about those first two kinds of desire, which I'm very adamant about? You know, is it wrong? Is it the eighth link of dependent origination? You know, is it such a nasty, horrible trigger in this series of rebirth to not want something that's undesirable and to want something that's desirable?
To do with your attachment to that thing.
Not so much attachment, but it has to do with what? Your perception of what of the self-existence of this thing does. And that it's fine to want paradise. You
better.
I hope so. That's how you're supposed to be here, you know. The result of this class is eventually, you know, you would get a very nice paradise. You know, suffering. And your desire is to escape this lousy life where you get older and everything you've worked for falls apart and you die. I mean, that's the whole point of this class. So that's not... But you must perceive yourself in the right way. And that's the person that you don't want to suffer and the person that you want to reach paradise. You better be perceiving him or her the right way. Because if you're not, you'll do the wrong deeds. You know, to get happy, you will struggle and fight and hurt other people. And to avoid pain, you will hurt. You know? And that's absolutely the opposite of the correct perception of this.
A double question. One time when I had reason to think that I was going to die pretty soon, but I had still a few minutes left, and all my consciousness went inside my body because I was incapable of moving. And I found this to be a very interesting experience and not fearful, part A. And part B, suppose we in this class subscribe, really believe that our consciousness is a continuum and that when this body dies, we really are going to flop over into something else. What about the first one, and will the second one militate against a bad reaction?
First question. You didn't get to the level of desperate hallucinations and the terrorist stuff.
Okay.
Your elements didn't collapse at that point. If they had, you wouldn't be talking about it. And then the second question, which was... Actually, the study of future lives in the Lam Rim structure, where does it come? Why is it there? Why does Dharmakirti get his little place in the Lam Rim? He's there. He only comes there where they talk about past and future lives. Well, it's to become a person, it's to reach the level where you're concerned about what's going to happen after you die. No big Buddhism stuff. I mean, no big paradise and no big nirvana stuff. You're supposed to then, once you have a perception of yourself as screaming on, you're supposed to worry that you don't turn out like Mr. Beetlejuice. You know. Did you see that movie? It was great. It's really good. No, the man and wife, they're on a normal drive through the countryside, they get in a car accident, and then suddenly they're in this fantastic chaos of all this chaos and stuff. And in the next moment, in the next second, they're in this horrible, frightening, chaotic world that has no reason or rhyme, and the people are burning, and people are, the house is, you know, it's, and that's exactly what happened. So that's supposed to be, you know, the study of future lives is supposed to be that you start to, you're you know, three breaths away from that happening at any given moment. You know, it could happen. It could likely happen.
And
it will happen one day.
Excuse me about that question.
Yeah.
So if we genuinely subscribe to this, how does that affect our response at the moment of death?
Long before that, you have to eliminate that kind of desire, which is aimed at a self-existent self, because that will make you act right. And then you won't have that coming. You'll probably be in paradise before that coming. Yes, ma'am.
I'm trying to put two things together. One, back to the very first class, and that's that list of characteristics of our existence or our existence. Being happy when you get something, unhappy when you don't, etc., etc. And I'm trying to sort of put it together with this. What you seem to be saying is that the quality, unless I misunderstand you, that it's not the quality of grasping or craving per se that's the problem, it's the object.
Hey, absolutely.
Where I always assume that the kind of, that what you feel when you want to achieve Buddhahood or whatever, or once you've seen emptiness directly, and is of a different quality.
Mm-mm.
And you're saying it's not.
Mm-mm.
It's the object.
I'm saying that if the object were correct, you'd be there.
But then where does that happy and unhappy fit in? But you're forming an attachment to something.
What's wrong with attachment? I mean, what's wrong with
attachment?
The object,
it's the way you perceive the object to exist.
Well, we're going to reach that. But what I'm saying is, I'm perfectly attached to reaching Vajrayana's paradise. I'm looking forward to it. You know, that's not. There's nothing wrong with that.
You go on the roller coaster because of your
attachment. I hate that idea. I reject that idea. I think that's a poorly formed contradiction of people who haven't thought very carefully about Buddhism. It's not that you are not supposed to reach a state where you don't care about anything and that's nirvana. No. Not like that. I mean, then these alcoholics over here did it.
I'm not talking about not caring. I'm just talking about that clutching quality.
That is a phenomenon. That's a concern, but it's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a good, healthy, cognizant, clear-minded desire to be out of suffering and reach everlasting pleasure. I have it, and I'm happy for it. And I don't think you'd be here if you didn't have it. You know, that's your goal, and that's in the back of everyone's mind when they study. It gets clearer as you get older.
So you're saying there's no such thing as studying something or having an object with the wrong emotions or the wrong reasons?
Because as long as the object is correct.
I'll say very clearly and very concisely. So long as you misperceive the object of your desire or hatred, you'll have the wrong kind of desire and the wrong kind of hatred. Yes.
We all do.
Yes, we do. Because we have the wrong perception. What's the good perception? I mean, temporarily, intellectually, remember that that object is blank, could have been pleasant, could have been bad, and the reason it's bad and you want to get away from it, or the reason it's pleasant and you want to get it, is that that otherwise blank object you have created into something pleasant or unpleasant, and you're forced to do that by your past karma. So if you don't like it, don't resist it, just change your karma. Stop acting bad. And it will change, but do it with knowledge.
But then what's grasping then? I thought grasping was a personification of craving.
It's a strengthening of craving.
Right.
Grasping is craving to brought to a new height. In the eighth and ninth links of the development. Very quickly, because we're not going to get our snack properly.
So
someone has brought a lot of nice snacks.
Can we finish the question?
Ready to grasp.
Well, I mean, does the...
I'm about to grasp.
I mean, does the perception of the object that's being sought after change in some way the nature of the craving, or does the Buddha crave to be free from suffering in the exact same way we would crave to win the lottery?
No, obviously.
We're talking about the quality.
Okay. So, no. So,
well, I'd say, no, I don't know.
I know you'd like to say you don't know. And you'd like to
I'd
say...
I'd like to say what you say.
And Rinpoche always said that, no, desire in itself is bad.
I explained it in the class. But it's a mistranslation. He's thinking of the word dacha instead of the word dupa. And in English, they're both the same word. Chong de and chong de, the words desire, appear in the definition of great compassion. And the other word, de cha, is always a bad word. In English, they're both translated desire. That's just a translation problem.
So I can't get enough of it, I gotta have it all the time. It's also experienced by a Buddha.
It's two different words in Tibetan that are translated with the English desire. Desire, you know, to get away from a self-existent bad object, and desire to reach Buddhahood and understand that it's not self-existent. They're totally different words in Tibetan. And that's where Rinpoche gets hung up on that. It's just a translation problem. It's just between Dupa and Dacha. Anyway, we'll go on. It's a similar emotion. Let's put it that way. I mean, it's a desire to get something nice. And that's fine. That's why you're here. You want to get to Nirvana. You know.
So then the Buddha doesn't suffer because he happens to be lucky enough to have an ever-present, continuing stream of this nice thing.
The Buddha has a dhyapa to see. He has a desire to see all beings free of suffering. He would like to see that. He has desire to see all beings free of suffering.
And he doesn't suffer because even though all beings are not free of suffering, he doesn't really have desire for that.
He doesn't have the kind of desire which misperceives its object and therefore causes bad karma and causes bad results. No,
which is the same exact desire that we have, it's just that the object is perceived incorrectly by us.
I say that. No. I would say that's the only difference between us. Yeah.
Because I thought there was another
quality. Because I think that's the whole... What I'm trying to say is that the whole key... So what you're trying to do. Why are you here? You want to get free of suffering. And the word for wanting to get free of suffering and the word wanting to help other beings by the Buddha is the same word. For a reason. It's the desire to get that object. It's a want. It's a desire. It's a wish. You know? That's why they're the same word. So think about it. Cook it. Okay. Last question. The key to why craving triggers your existing karma at the moment of death is how it focuses upon yourself. Describe the four levels of focusing upon yourself and explain which ones can trigger this karma. Then I'll answer this one. It's a little difficult. First, one of the four is called ordinary conventional perception of yourself. Thinking, Ariel thinking of Ariel as me, I thinking of myself as me. And this is just unexamined perception of yourself. And even the Buddha has this. So that should tell you whether or not it can trigger a future life in samsara. Okay? No, everybody has. The Buddha thinks of his robes as his. If somebody came to, you know, Varanasi and took the Buddha's robes, the Buddha would think someone stole my robes. And that's direct quotation from scripture. So that's okay, nothing wrong with that. It's just unexamined me. And that's where a lot of Buddhists, you know, they teach you there's no me, and you get confused, and you go home and worry about that it's wrong to think about Helen McHale, and, you know, you spend a few years on that, and you're confused. That's fine, you are yourself. Why? You have a tema about it, you have a phrāmaṇa.
So when you say it triggers its existing karma?
That does not.
It does not.
At the moment of death, that one, everybody has it. And that's no problem.
One question. You said that all these Buddhas.
Oh, yeah. Are you not yourself? Are you not Robin?
Yes, but I'm not the Buddha. And you said that only the Buddha can have it.
All the time.
Earlier.
All the time.
All the time.
Yeah,
all
yeah.
The time.
Yeah. Only some.
Okay.
No, because the Buddha has it. If it triggered, then the Buddha would have to take a samsara if it's possible. Okay, next one. You believe and also see a self-existent you. That describes any person who has not yet seen emptiness directly.
How is that different than the first one? Ordinary perception of yourself?
The explanation is that at this point you're more thinking about the nature of yourself. I said unexamined before, now I'm saying examined. But it's not that you're consciously examining, so that's enough. So that describes a non-Arya, right? Number three is anyone who's an Arya but not yet a Buddha.
So you have to say this one triggers.
And it, oh yeah, it does trigger rebirth. Number three is a person who is an Arya, he did see what?
Emptiness.
Ever. Directly. Okay. But he's not yet a Buddha. He sees himself as self-existent, but he doesn't believe it. He knows he's crazy. Mm-hmm. He knows he's wrong.
He
but he can't stop it. He sees himself as self-existent. But he doesn't believe his own eyes anymore. He doesn't believe himself anymore.
He sees himself as not self-existent, but doesn't believe it.
No. Yeah. By the way, I'm talking about when he comes, after he comes out of his great vision. Okay. Maybe you're confused by that. Post-great vision. Okay. After his great vision, until the point he becomes a Buddha, he does not believe that he's self-existent, because he knows he's not. But he can't stop seeing it that way. Except for times when he's in the direct perception, in meditation of emptiness. Except all other times, he still sees things as self. They still appear to him as self-existent. But he doesn't believe it anymore. He knows it's wrong. He knows his own perceptions are wrong. His perception of himself is also going to trigger a rebirth. That's why even after you see emptiness directly, until you become an arhat, you must take leave.
Would the second one include intellectually understanding about emptiness? Or
yeah.
Not necessarily?
Yeah, you can have some very advanced intellectual understanding of emptiness and still be at number two. Now, number four.
Can you be at number two without being an Arya?
You must not be an Arya to be at number two. Can you be a non-Arya and be at number three? No.
So advanced intellectual understanding.
It's not enough. Direct perception. Okay, number four.
Sees and believes.
Neither sees nor believes.
Neither sees.
Nor believes.
Oh.
in a self-existent being. That describes two kinds of beings. Buddha, all the time. And who else?
Arhat.
Well, Arhats are joined with Buddha. Who else?
Aryas,
while they're in their vision, you know, while they're in the direct perception of emptiness, they don't see us. They don't see themselves as self-existent, and they don't believe it either.
But I thought they don't see themselves.
They don't see that either. That's true. But it's not like a guy that Mike Tyson knocked out. Okay, that's a different kind of not seeing and not believing.
Well, seeing and believing is one step up.
It distracts us. We have,
right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a very. Yeah. That's, by the way, as the courses go on, hopefully you'll start to see interlinks, hypertext, and then by the end of the 5 years, you'll see that everything links. You'll start to hear things like ideas over. Have a break for 5 minutes. Come back. I just wanted to show you something for 5 minutes.
Can we tell us 5 minutes and then we'll do the break after?
Why don't we just do that now?
People that want to stay for a break and do that.
Okay.
Go for it.
I want to read you something. Do you remember that the other class was translating something?
Thank you.
Yes. They were going to come and present it, and they never did because I was giving you it. It was the story. Do you remember the story? It was from a sutra. It's called the Sutra of the Origination of the Unoriginated, or something like that. And a sangha, it was a favorite of Atisha. Atisha liked this sutra. He quotes it in one of his works, in the Tengger. And he says, I don't know if you remember, there was a planet. It's like, reads like science fiction. There's a planet. On this planet, a Buddha appears. The Buddha teaches people all over, and people actually turn on the whole planet. Everybody on the planet becomes either an Arya or an Arhat, or, you know, they turn on to his teaching. It's another Buddha in another era, millions and millions of years ago, and the whole planet becomes a Dharma planet, and everybody is going to Dharma classes, and everyone's becoming enlightened and meditating all the time, the whole planet. And then at some point, the Buddha, you know, his time passes. He decides to withdraw that emanation. And he appoints a certain monk to be his... Did we get that far?
Yeah.
He appoints a certain monk. He lives for 10 million years or something, and then he decides it's time to withdraw this emanation. And he appoints a certain monk. And he says, this monk is going to be my regent. You know, this monk will be the first throne holder. So this monk is living in a certain monastery. And he has all these followers, and they start to go to the cities. They, you know, a monastery has to be 500 gyantaks, fathoms from a town. You're not allowed to have a monastery closer to a town than that. So, and this monk, he takes his followers every day. Instead of going for begging around the monastery, they actually go into the town and they start teaching the people in the city, which is unheard of. You know, the monks are supposed to stay out in the countryside and not mix with city people. And this other monk starts to get... He sees one of the followers touch a lady or with a lady or something like that. So he assumes that this is why everyone's going to the cities. And he starts to have meetings to say no monk should go to the cities. This is very bad. Even though those monks are teaching people bodhicitta and people actually reaching bodhicitta and things like that. So he has a big meeting, and they all decide that this monk and his followers shouldn't go to the cities anymore.
The regent monk.
Yeah.
Who's leading the cities.
The second monk, who's not the regent, says that the regent is corrupt and he's going to the cities, and this is why he's going to the cities. And he does this long meeting. They have this long. So out of respect, not wanting to cause a division in the sangha, the regent stays in the monastery. And then the city people don't get taught, and no one's getting bodhicitta, and things start to collapse. And then he says, look, I can't stay away anymore. I'll move to another monastery, and then I'll continue my work in the city teaching the people. So he moves out of the monastery and goes back. Then the second monk, right, the one who criticized him, dies. And he goes to hell for like billions of lives. For having assumed this about the region without knowing. And for millions of lives he loses his robes. He becomes a monk and he loses his robes during his life. And then for millions of lives he's born as a very stupid person who can't understand anyone. And, you know, no matter how many times you explain it to him, he can't get it. I mean, for tens of millions of lives this goes on. Because of the grave karma that he collected by making an assumption that, without knowing. And then the Buddha, in the last line of the sutra, which I, you know, it's here, but I'll just describe. He says, and don't think that the first monk was just a normal person. He is the Buddha of Nigulwa. Nigulwa is he became a Buddha like a few million years ago. He was the Buddha of Nigulwa. He later became the Buddha of Nigulwa. And the monk who criticized him, who went to hell, was me.
I mean, who?
Shakyamuni is saying, I was that monk and I made that mistake. And because of it, I had to live all those lives in the hell. So don't think it's somebody else that you've never heard of. It was me. And I'm telling you from experience. And then he says, Kansaki tsu sumu michate nyama jokate. And that's the source of that conversation. And nobody in the monastery knows that. I mean,
why don't you tell?
I'm starting. But this is the cool thing about the computer, so you can ask, and it can go back to you 100,000 pages and look. And that's where the Buddha says that. So don't judge other people you will fall if you're not like me. And that's the source of that quotation, and he's talking about himself. And that's the... I think that's the neat...
You have to say,
according to what I can see, it looks bad, and I cannot follow that, I reject it, and I resist it. But you can't, you know, you have to be careful to say, I know. But of course, if something looks bad, you know, this came up with certain teachers that drink or stuff, and say, look, I don't know. People ask me, what do you think about these guys? I said, I don't know. I really don't know. I can't do it. I know it's not right to do it. And I won't do it myself. Can I judge a person? No. Should you follow a person? That's up to you. I can't say that. I think the thought merely the thought. If they don't stress the fact that the other one has to move, he just moved later. It seems like almost an after story.
So basically, like the whole thing that we studied in this class, if the Buddha was able to be mindful enough at that moment, and have the best pramana that he was capable of having at that time, which was to say to himself, gee, it really looks bad,
yeah.
But instead of going, making a leap of faith beyond that, saying that it is bad, and if he stayed back and it really looks bad, and it could actually be bad, or it could actually be something very high, I can't tell the difference yet at my level. He presumably could have avoided all that.
Yeah. It says, by the way, just a statement, he is that. I know him to be that. Is the mistake he the decision without a tema that this is what it is. It
sort of points to the relativity of all of these rules, right? I mean,
well, then Gyaltsev Jain, in his commentary, says, you know, we do this all the time. He says we should take it to heart, and it's beautiful. At the end, he says, it's a beautiful line at the end. He says, therefore, a person. It's really beautiful. He says, don't worry about other people. A Buddhist practitioner, his main object of his practice is not to go around correcting everyone else in the world. The main job, the task which you know to be, with sema, to be necessary, if you are who you seem to be, is to clean up your own mind. So he says, therefore, a really good Buddhist practitioner should go to his room, go to his home, do his practices, for himself, clean up his mind, and reach Buddhahood. And then he says a very interesting thing in the scripture. He says, and a person who does that is higher than all the bodhisattvas on such a planet, going and teaching people the 10 virtues and getting them to follow them. The person who goes to his own room in his own privacy and tries to work on himself is higher. Because he will reach Buddha. That person will clean up his mind, and that person will reach Buddha, and a Buddha is higher than all those bodhisattvas. He said that. What I mean to say is, I mean, if someone says, why do Buddhists study logic? You say, well, the main purpose is that we try to realize that we must work on ourselves and not worry so much about other people. You know, you have to be concerned, you have to help, you have to contribute, you have to resist evil. But the main, your main Dharma career is in your own mind and in your own room.
That sounds like Henry.
It's called Eating the Meat Yourself, which is in the Long Rim. And there's a man starving. You know the story? The man is starving. His family is starving. He finds a big chunk of meat. And he realizes if he eats it, he'll have enough energy to go get more food. But if he splits it up with everybody, they'll all die. So he eats it, the whole thing. And the main thrust you get, he's obviously not saying don't be compassionate, don't care about it. He's not saying that. He's saying work on yourself. You cannot know the level of the people around you. Maybe when you get to a very advanced state, you might learn something different about the people around you. But for now, just worry about...
been listening to The Proof of Future Lives with Geshe Michael Roach, presented by the Asian Classics Institute. The Asian Classics Institute is dedicated to preserving the pure teachings and practice of Buddhism. For a listing of other topics available, write to the Asian Classics Institute, P.O. Box 20373, New York, New York, 10009, or call 212-475-7752.